Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and time to take a look at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, Emeritus Professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison and UW Extension. Always great to have him come by. And I know we'll be talking a bit about the wildlife in your garden or in your area, and we can also talk about feeding birds in summers and a whole lot more. So join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. And Scott Craven, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Well, good morning, Larry, and listeners. It's great to be back. Been a lot of running around lately, so it's nice to sit down.
Yeah, what's all this travel business? What have you been up to?
Oh, mostly family related. We just had a wonderful weekend up in the Northwoods in our place in Price County with son and daughter and both their families, and so we had 10 people and 3 dogs in the cabin, and mercifully the weather was gorgeous, so we were outside most of the time. The fishing was great and the bugs weren't bad, and it was just a glorious weekend in the northern, well, I think statewide, but a very nice weekend. So we were up there, and we had just gotten back a couple days before then from 8 or 9 days out at roaming around New Hampshire and Maine, trying to do my part for the seafood surplus that I'd heard about, but I don't think I made much of a dent. But we had, as you know, Larry, both my wife and I are from New Hampshire, and we had some family matters back there and some folks we wanted to see, and had a great time roaming around, and I learned for about the 19th time that leaving your garden for periods of 10 or 12 days at this time of year is ill-advised, and I've got a few weeds and other problems to deal with, but the relevant problem today is that the rabbits are driving me crazy.
There are rabbits everywhere.
There seem to be a lot of rabbits, and that may be part of one of the other topics we hope to cover a little bit today, is that it's just been a pretty good growing season for the most part. It's been warm, it's been timely rains, and there's a lot of vegetation out there, and that hides rabbits, and it keeps rabbits fat and healthy, and even with all that natural vegetation, they just won't leave my beans and lettuce alone. So I'm trying to deal with that, and I suspect people are also having trouble with ground squirrels and deer and a variety of other things. So
we'll see. Yeah, here's a photo up on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show of a very dead squirrel. Connie Jo sent it. She found this on the road between Mount Horeb and Verona, and it looks like a half-black, half-red squirrel.
It doesn't appear to be in its natural habitat either. That looks a lot like asphalt. So,
yeah.
Well, it looks to me, I can only see the belly surface, but with the rusty-colored tail and that dark belly, I think it's a big old fox squirrel.
Oh,
not a color variant of gray squirrels, although, as we've talked about many times before, gray squirrels do come in a variety of color phases, and over the last decade or so, there seem to be even more combinations than either the jet black, the white, the golden yellow, or the typical gray, but I think this is just a very dark-colored fox squirrel.
All right, there we go. Well, we have callers online with questions. I tell you what, let's turn to KC. We'll go there in Port Wing. KC, thanks for calling.
Well, good afternoon. How are you guys today?
Good.
Mr. Craven, welcome back from the live free or die state of New Hampshire. Glad you're back.
Well, thank you.
Okay, well, I would like to ask you a couple of questions about the timberwolf population. I know in the southern part of the state, it really doesn't affect the people as much as it does in the northern part of the state. And I'm from Bayfield County. And Douglas and Ashland and Iron County surround us, and the Timberwolves, you know, they had a count, allegedly, and they counted every one. I'm sure they didn't miss any. There's 860 Timberwolves in the state of Wisconsin, with a large portion in the central and northern part of the state. And I don't think they counted the ones that didn't inadvertently come across from Minnesota and Michigan, because they must have, like, a tag on them or something that says, we're from Michigan or Minnesota. So they didn't count those, which is kind of weird. But anyway, the timberwolf population in the northern part of the state is really out of control. And you have to admit, because when they first came with timberwolves to the state of Wisconsin, I believe the number was 350 that they wanted to keep it at. Of course, you cannot keep timberwolves from breeding. They breed quite rapidly, and they produce a lot of offspring. Now there's almost 1,000 timberwolves in the state of Wisconsin.
Well, are there 1,000 timberwolves in the state of Wisconsin?
Well, right now, with pups born, there's probably well over 1,000. So let's backtrack just a second, Larry. The count, and I even kind of hate to use the term count because it's more of a population. It's a minimum at best in terms of numbers, and it's determined more by tracking and inference than it is actually running around out there counting wolves. That's simply not possible. But in any event, the numbers for 2015-16 were released a few weeks ago in mid-June, and the minimum count is always issued as a range, and it was 866 to 897, or pushing 900, say between 850 and 900, in 222 packs. And I think the key thing is that this represents a 16% increase from last year's minimum count, and there was a slight increase the year before that, too. Since the animals were put back on the endangered species list and that three-year experiment that we had with the wolf hunting season ended.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, go figure. They're not hunted or trapped, and therefore there are more of them. That only makes sense. As Casey pointed out, they do reproduce, and conditions are pretty good for the wolves now. So, yes, there are either a lot or a few wolves, depending on your point of view. I mean, 900 animals as a winter count, even if it's up to, say, for the sake of argument, 1,500 right now because of all the pups being born, as soon as those pups are added to the population, they'll begin diminishing as there's mortality in pups and some adults and so forth until you get back down to the low point next winter and they do another minimum count, which may or may not be up. I'm not sure what to say about that. This count has been described as a record high for Wisconsin. Have to qualify that a little bit in terms of it. That's in contemporary times, since we've been paying some attention to wolves and wolf management plan since the latter part of the last century. Certainly pre-settlement times, there were likely quite a few more wolves than that on the landscape. But in modern times, it's a high. Depending on where you are in the state and what your mindset is, that's either way too many or not enough or just about right, and that's kind of where we are with wolf management until the federal government and the legal system can make some sort of a decision that these animals will remain on the endangered species list for an extended time period or should be delisted, which I personally would like to see happen so that management of the wolf population would return to state overview. The debate will range on. The number of 350 that the previous caller mentioned was the number or the goal for the population in the wolf management plan that was produced 20 years ago. And some folks have hung on to that number for a long time with the thought that anything over 350 must be too many and extra wolves. But, you know, on the one hand, Wisconsin's a big state. Yes, they're concentrated in the northern third of the state, but and some in kind of the central part of the state. But, you know, 900 animals over a state the size of Wisconsin, it's not a whole lot of animals. But if you if your deer hunting camp or your property mm-hmm. or your cattle ranch happens to be near one or more packs, it changes the whole dynamic. So it depends on who you are, where you are, how you feel, what you think. But the bottom line is it's about 900 animals, give or take a few, for this particular winter. And there's a very nice map showing the distribution of where these animals were detected on the front cover of the last issue of Outdoor News. Or people can go to the DNR website and click on the wolf management or go to the wolf management website and learn all about the current count, its interpretation, how, if they want, they can become volunteer trackers who help determine what this number is. There's a lot of good information there. But the bottom line is, yes, we have a modern high as far as the wolf population and what that means and what will be done about it.
Who knows?
Who knows?
Well, Griffin, you were talking about rabbits earlier, and Griffin emailed to say that lavender oil is a great rabbit repellent year-round.
Hmm.
It's inexpensive, and you don't need a lot. Just sprinkle it around plants. The smell is strong and lasts a long time. Have you heard of lavender oil before?
I have not, but I'll be, as soon as I leave the studio today, I'll be looking for a barrel of it. You know, folks do have some, over the years, there's been success reported with all sorts of kind of semi-home remedies or things that people hear about and try. Some of them work, some of them don't. So if the caller has had good luck with lavender oil, by all means, you know, keep it up and give it a try. And if other people want to try it, go ahead. But generally speaking, repellents have limitations, especially when you're getting periodic heavy thunderstorms like we had last night. Some of these things that are applied wash away rather quickly or are diluted. And it only takes, in my experience, one night and a couple hungry rabbits to really decimate a row of green beans or lettuce or what have you. So you have to be a little bit cautious, but you know, fencing, rabbit removal, some of the steps that actually reduce the number of rabbits or prevent them from getting to what you're trying to protect in the long run seem to bear fruit. But
well, what if it comes to skunks? Here we've got, I'm trying to find it now. There it is. Cheryl posted on Facebook to say that a family of skunks took up residence under her farm. I assume one of the farm buildings. Will they move on to new territory?
Not if they like it there. You know, a family of skunks under a deck or an outbuilding or garage slab or whatever is usually viewed as a bit of a problem. Generally, they're pretty docile animals,
yeah.
And if you learn a little bit about them and kind of give them a bit of a wide berth and you don't have pets that are going to interact with them, you know, coexistence is a possibility, but most people want them removed. In some cases, you can get lucky, and if you know where they're burrowing or where they've tunneled under a slab or under a deck, a handful of naphthalene flakes or mothball flakes or a little bit of ammonia on a rag may be enough to convince them that, hey, we better find a more welcoming environment, and they move on. In which case, it's important then to skirt the deck or do something with wire or whatever so that those dens are not reused or reopened. But if that kind of thing doesn't work, you're really talking about dealing with removing the skunks. They're pretty easy to catch in a live trap, but that generates a whole new set of concerns when you actually have one in the trap. So for most people, it's probably worth the investment to contact an animal removal company, somebody who knows what they're doing, has the traps, comes and catches the skunks and removes them. If you choose to do it as a DIY project, then you certainly can, but be prepared that moving the skunks in the trap or what have you can be a bit stressful. If you cover the trap with something dark, you know, an old tarp or old blanket or something like that, you can usually pick up the trap and move it to a place where you can deal with the skunk without risk of being sprayed. But if you jostle the trap or are a little awkward, and the last one I caught a month or so ago when I was trying to remove a raccoon from the bird feeders, it turned out to be a skunk, and I walked up to it with an old blanket and talked kindly to it and softly and covered the trap. The skunk was fine. I knelt down, opened the trap door again very carefully. I didn't care about removing the skunk. I just wanted him out of the trap. But he wouldn't come out of the trap. And being a less than entirely patient person, I eventually, I'll just encourage him. And I tapped on the trap. And the skunk didn't care for that. And instead of leaving, he sprayed me. And that's the... That's the risk involved with handling them yourself. But they're not hard to remove. But having someone who knows what they're doing is probably the best idea.
Yeah,
I think first try something fairly non-invasive, like a good odorous repellent, and see if you can get them to move on.
Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Malik Anderson, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The Olympic Games are only a few weeks away, and at 1 o'clock today, this afternoon, Kathleen Dunn and her guests will talk about whether Brazil is ready and talk about other questions surrounding the Games. Right now, though, we're taking a look at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist. Great to have him along. Thank you so much for listening in. Join in at 800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Scott, we had a rather unfortunate incident here just recently with a car apparently hit a deer. The deer came over that car and into the windshield of another driver and killed the driver in the second car.
Yes, that was just yesterday. It was in the morning paper this morning, and it's really an unfortunate thing because you can be driving along, doing everything right, watching the roadside for deer if it's at a time of day or in a location where that might be a risk. You're doing the right thing, and all of a sudden, here comes a deer flying over a car and whomp, gone.
Yeah.
So I guess the there are a couple of things to just make the listeners aware of. Number one, deer are out and about in force right now. The deer population, we're just at the tail end of the fawn drop, so much like the wolves we were talking about, the highest deer population we're ever going to have in Wisconsin over the next year is right now.
Right now.
And that will, of course, diminish, just like the number of wolves with mortality. So there are a lot of deer out there, and you need to be observant. I've always maintained that the best defense against deer, and it's not foolproof, is just to be pay attention to the deer crossing signs, be particularly cautious at sunrise and sunset, at dusk. Not only is it a little harder to see, but the deer are on the move then, and slow down a bit if you're in a vulnerable area. It's hitting a deer is a very stressful thing, and can be a fatal or injury-causing event. So be aware that there are a lot of deer out there. Be a little defensive and alert, and be careful because people are killed in Wisconsin every year in deer vehicle collisions, and it's a very tragic thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Jocelyn in Sheboygan up next. Jocelyn, hi. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, hi. I was wondering, I have a question and a comment. I was wondering why in Wisconsin we have approximately 29,000 black bears, and as he just said, around 900 wolves, which is a huge difference. And I'm wondering why it's so imperative to want to kill off the wolves to 350 for the whole state. And the comment I have is why, years ago they changed the, like for the Humane Society, they changed the wording from buying puppy or kitten to adopting, which changes the mentality of people. And I'm just wondering why the euphemism of harvesting, as if, referring to the killing of animals instead of, harvesting corn. I just feel that's terrible. Maybe people would have more respect for other living creatures, if they use different wording.
Well, I mean, it's always been awkward. There are a variety of euphemisms. But the bottom line is that deer, bears, wolves, pheasants, ruffed grouse, ducks, a whole host of animals, birds and mammals in Wisconsin are considered game birds or mammals and are legally hunted or trapped. And whether you want to call that take, which is another euphemism, whether you want to call the taking of those animals killing or harvesting or take or anything else is again a matter of personal mindset. But the bottom line is it doesn't really matter. The animals are killed. And the comment on the screen was, why is it okay to kill wolves but not bears? It is somewhat inaccurate because the bear harvest annually is 4,000 or 5,000 animals. The wolf harvest that occurred several years ago, for 3 years, was around 150. So the take or kill or harvest is always somewhat proportional to the size of the population and is pretty closely managed by the Department of Natural Resources. So it's 150 out of 800 or 900 wolves, it's 4,000 or 5,000 out of 28,500 bears, it's 300,000 or 400,000 deer out of maybe 1.3 or 4 or 5 million. So it's all considered to be a take or harvest of or killing, which has been acceptable for many years in Wisconsin, is important for the management or control of these species, and in the case of wolves and bears, managing some of the problems they cause. Well, probably the same thing when you think about deer and this deer vehicle collision we just talked about.
Sure.
So it happens. It's generally accepted in Wisconsin. Hunting is a strong tradition and heritage in the state, and
yep.
There you have it.
There we go. Well, let's turn to Vilas in Richland Center. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hey. Got a problem.
Okay.
It's primarily deer. I don't have any rabbits. I guess it's because the cats scare them away.
I can help you with that problem if you want a bag full.
But I do have two problems. One problem is where my garden is. I had two beautiful rows of beans and peas. And I have fence that it's leased, barbed wire fence, five stays, five lines, and at least 8 feet high, but they still must jump it. And they ate all my beans off the other night, all the tops, and they were in bloom. Years ago, for the rabbits, we'd use a thing called blood meal, and that would keep the rabbits back. But I don't know what to do. I've got scarecrows up. I've got lines strung with aluminum plates that cling and bang and glow in the dark, and nothing helps. They still come in there and eat my beans off.
Just a question. How high is your lowest barbed wire?
I have woven wire up to about 4 feet.
Oh, my goodness. Hmm. I was going to say, they can get underneath a pretty low, but if you've got woven wire.
Yes, then barbed wire.
Wow. Well, I was thinking the same thing. I mean, given the opportunity, deer will almost always go through or under a strand fence before they'll try and jump it. And since it's barbed wire, I was going to suggest, well, look at some of the barbs.
I looked on the barbed wire. I don't see any deer hair in the barbed wire anywhere.
And there's no gate or breech or anything like that that they might be using?
No, but I do see tracks.
Mm. Well, you know, they're certainly physically capable of jumping 8 feet, but I'll just tell you, how big is, give me a rough estimate of the size of your garden.
Oh, 100 feet by 75.
Okay, well, mine's about 100 by 50, and I protect it with 5 foot welded wire and have not had only the very rare deer incursion, and I see them walking by looking longingly at what's in there, but generally, the smaller the garden plot, the lower the fence can be and be quite effective. So I'm sort of surprised that they're... When you said you're seeing tracks, you're seeing them inside the garden?
Yes.
Okay, so it's clearly they're getting in there. And really, for a row of beans, it only takes one animal to have figured out how to defeat the fence, and they can mow down they'll eat about 8 pounds of green vegetation a day, so that's a lot of bean plants.
They don't bother potatoes?
Nope, they won't eat potatoes.
They don't seem to be bothering the peppers. They're not bothering the cauliflower. They're not bothering the broccoli.
Well, give them a chance. Give them a chance on the coal crops. Once they finish the beans, they might. But things like cucumbers, pumpkins, tomatoes, potatoes, peppers, generally most of those browsing animals won't mess with. But that doesn't change.
They're rough, yeah.
Yeah, that doesn't change your problem. I would have thought that.
What can you put on your plants? What can you put on your plants? That's what I'm wondering.
Well, the blood meal still works, but it doesn't weather very well. I had pretty good luck with a blood product, which I think is Swedish. It's called Plant Skid, SKYDD. And it's a dried blood product, but you mix it into a slurry. And last year when I was really besieged by rabbits, I just haven't had a chance this year, I just made a slurry of it and left some of it out around the peas and beans and pie plates, and that seemed to be enough to stop the problem. So that's one product. There are certainly other deer repellents that a garden center or hardware store can fix you up with, but some of them are not designed for use on plant materials that will be consumed, like lettuce leaves. Naphthalene that I mentioned a minute ago in the case of the skunks is very odorous, and most mammals detest that. So some small mesh bags, maybe the size of a golf ball or a small apple of naphthalene flakes distributed every 5 or 6 feet down your row, maybe suspended from a little stake, might also be enough to do the job. And for a row of something where the plants aren't that huge, if these are bush beans, tenting the row with chicken wire that you just bend over and secure would also protect them, and then you just peel that back when you want to harvest. Even black plastic bird netting, same thing, tent it over, or you run essentially a rod or a 2x4 down over the row and then drape the bird netting over it. The deer don't like to try and go through that stuff either. So there's a couple possibilities, but the fence you describe, I would have suspected would be doing the job.
Yeah, for sure.
So good luck. Yeah. Dealing with some of these animal problems in a garden is a gardener's worst frustration. I feel your pain, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
Oh, man. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. I want to give Paul in Milwaukee a chance to join in with a different kind of problem. Hi, Paul.
Hi. I have a small farm in northern Manitowoc County, and I have pasture-raised chickens, and I noticed they started disappearing, and now I've lost about 40 of them, and my neighbor saw a great horned owl fly by, and I found two feathers next to chicken carcasses that were large brown and white stripes. Feathers, and when I looked up on the internet, it said they belong to the great horned owl. What can I do to deter the great horned owl from eating my chicken?
If you're going to be dealing with free range chickens, probably not much. I mean, those chickens are going to be vulnerable, not just to owls, but potentially to coyotes, fox. Mm-hmm. Various mustelids like a mink or a weasel and all sorts of things. Now, a number of those problems can be at least minimized by. Do you bring the chickens in at night and pen them up?
No, I'm not there all of the time, but they have a coop that they go into, and it's about a half acre area that is fenced off. So it's just from the air that I'm getting the attack. And does that mean that owls nesting somewhere around there, or that they're going to be there forever?
The sad well, I shouldn't say sad reality. If you like owls, and I like hearing great horned owls hooting,
yeah.
But I'd be surprised if there's a good sized woodlot anywhere in the southern part of the state that doesn't have a pair of horned owls using it from time to time. So they're that common. If you're confident that the birds are getting back into the enclosure at night and therefore you're not dealing with some of the weasel problems or other things, rather covering the pen, or at least a portion of the pen with bird netting, is really the only alternative. And occasionally, if the owls are harassing the birds, the chickens, and they're flushing and flying up against the netting, the owls may still catch an occasional one through the netting and decapitate them. But if they're out in the open, the owl's going to get them. And even if you could get the necessary permit and permission and whatnot to remove the owl, which is not going to be a very easy thing to do, there are enough of them around that that's going to be a losing proposition. So perhaps a smaller pen, this plastic bird netting, or any type of netting is readily accessible. Garden centers sometimes carry it in huge rolls.
Relatively inexpensive.
It's relatively inexpensive. It's not ugly. You can hardly see it from a distance. And that really is the only thing I know of that might provide you with some certainty of relief.
You know, the question I had is I thought owls were nocturnal, yet my chickens are in the coop at night.
And the dead birds you found are out in the open.
Right. Next to the coop, outside next to the coop.
Well, you know, it really is a fine line between them getting to the coop. The owls are nocturnal, but that's a relative thing. And if the chickens, you know, waiting until last light or whatnot to move into the coop, then there may be a short window there where they're vulnerable to the owls.
And the owl probably knows that.
And the owls probably figured that out, as Larry suggests here. So you really need to, you know, round them up or do what you can to get them under protection, or they're going to be vulnerable. And
if they're near the building itself, maybe you could put some netting there. You know, that'd be a possibility. If they're almost getting there but not quite making it, maybe you put some netting there around that area, and you wouldn't have to put as much. At least it'd be worth a try, wouldn't it, Scott?
It's worth a try, but basically I think you need to provide some physical protection that the birds that your birds can utilize.
There you go. Good luck, Paul. Thank you very much for calling. Melanie in Polk County, I think we kind of covered this, Scott.
We did.
Melanie, are you there?
Yes, I am.
You can't put up a fence. Did you hear some of Scott's other suggestions?
Well, I heard the naphthalene flake suspended from a stake. I don't have like an air, you know, pollinators. I've got hundreds of them and shrubs and stuff like spread all over, like 1.5 acres. So I don't have this plot where I can, you know, I mean, it's really random and free flowing, and I can't do a fence either. So does the naphthalene flakes, is there anything else besides that you could recommend? I mean, do I need to put that everywhere?
The situation that you described, Melanie, in a, you know, essentially a wide open area and apparently deer habitat nearby, I'm not going to say it's a lost cause, but it's a very difficult one to think about putting anything by way of repellents that are going to do the job. And, you know, if you've got a particularly favorite specimen shrub of something, you know, for whatever reason, it's something you just really want to protect, then those are the plant materials that I would consider putting a stake with, either naphthalene flakes, or some people have reasonable luck with hair. I never found it to be that accessible, that acceptable.
What was the blood one?
The blood product, the plant skid, the blood meal product can be mixed with water and sprayed. And for example, outside my garden, I was having trouble a couple of years ago with a lot of small trees I'd established around my 12-acre prairie, and the bucks were rubbing on those and so forth, and I just took some of this blood meal material, mixed it into a slurry that I could spray, and then sprayed the trunks of these little aspens and other trees that were being beaten up, and that seemed to provide some relief. But when it comes to eating and consuming these plants, if it's at a time of year when food's in short supply, the deer are going to overcome most repellents. This time of year, growth is so rapid, and there's so much stuff out there right now. Unless you've got an incredible deer density, I don't think they could cause enough damage to warrant a huge effort on your part to try and prevent it right now.
Yeah, there you go.
So, Yeah, they're taking all the flowers that it's a three-legged, believe it or not, it's a three-legged female deer with two fawns. I've seen her, and she's been here for a couple years, you know, and she's nothing is blooming. I mean, all the efforts to get help the environment and help insects, it's all lost because of these deer, you know?
Well, you know, there are other more technological or sophisticated approaches. There are motion sensors, for example, that you can put up, which will then trigger anything from an elevated sprayer to some type of noisemaker that may just make it uncomfortable enough for the deer that they move on to another food source. But again, I would try and pick the shrubs or plantings that you're most concerned about and physically cover or protect them with some of these repellents and hope for the best.
Another solution is to have a well-trained dog. Mm-hmm. If you had an outside dog, you're probably not going to have that kind of problem, or a dog that can spend a lot of time outside.
Yeah, and even just I've got two labs, Labrador Retrievers, as you know, Larry, and when we're home and the dogs are around, even if they're not out roaming around with us, because we keep them under pretty tight control, but just having them there and them occasionally seeing, I don't know what, but barking like crazy at the windows, that seems to make a difference, because when we're gone and take the dogs and we come back, it's like, you know, we barely clear the driveway and you can hear the animals rushing in to the yard and garden to dine. So that's a good point, that having a dog around, I'm not sure we're advocating, you know, heading out to the humane shelter and picking up a couple of dogs if you don't want a pet, but it is another option.
There you go, Melanie. Thank you so much for calling. And John in, well, here's John in Janesville.
Here's a suggestion.
Yeah, hang on. Here's a suggestion. Hi, John.
Hi. How you doing?
Good.
I just had one. I've been listening to the stuff dealing with the deer and whatnot, and I have the same issues. I live in a relatively rural subdivision, and we have the whole deal with the deer. And I have a garden, and I used to have been starting to chew on my tomatoes and which they hadn't in the past, and eaten various everything. But I did discover, I just came across online through a YouTube picture or statement, was a wildlife agent from Kentucky or Tennessee. He fenced his garden area, a very large garden area, with just T-bars, poles, and 30-pound weight monofilament fish line, and put them at 2 feet or a foot and a half, 3 feet, 4 feet, 6 feet, something like that, a foot or a foot and a half in between each, and it took care of his deer problem. I tried it last year. I'm on my second year, and I haven't had deer in my garden. It doesn't keep the rabbits out, but it kept the deer out so far. And his point is that since the monofilament line is virtually invisible, and certainly when they're out at night, they bump into this line, and they don't know what they touched, and so they don't go through it. And it's worked for a year and a half.
Well, great.
Seeing is believing. So if you're going to string the poles and so forth too, the monofilament's worth a try. But there are many configurations of electric fence too that are inexpensive. And if they're solar powered, some of them are, the fences are baited with little strips of foil and with peanut butter to encourage the deer to make nose contact with the electrified wire. And they learn fairly quickly that that's a hostile environment. So for folks who are on the verge of desperation, electric fences, other fence configurations, some of the repellents, some of the motion sensor scare devices, look around on the internet, talk to people at your local garden center and see what's available, and good luck.
Thanks a lot for calling, John. Appreciate your call. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for being with us here on the Ideas Network as we take a look at the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller. Join in. We've got open lines at 1-800 646-642-1234. But go ahead and as well and post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of the page. Or email us at talk@WPR.org. And we'd certainly love to hear from you. And, oh, here we go with a Facebook comment. Oh, you should go on my Facebook page to see this. You don't have to be a member of Facebook to see it. Neil has sent me a photo, Neil, of a... He says it's a rodent problem. Well, actually, yeah, it's a pretty good-sized bear in his yard. And two of these guys live in the woods around us. There's a huge one that I've seen only once. It makes for coming out of my wood shop at night, shall I say, nerve-wracking.
It's a good picture.
It's a great picture of the bear. It's standing on its hind legs, and it's got to be a six-footer, maybe, was standing there. Yeah. So, it you know, not a lot you're going to do about those bears, is there?
Well, no, and the reality is that folks who live, if you live in a condo in downtown Madison, for example, it's challenging to relate to someone living in the country, in the North Woods, or anywhere else, wherever you live, for the people in the Southwest, there are some rattlesnakes around. For the people in the North Woods, there are bear and wolves. For people in Florida, there are alligators. And the bottom line is, when you live somewhere, there are animal issues that you somehow become accustomed to. And, you know, kids are brought up understanding that you don't do certain things around these animals. And over time, kind of a coexistence breaks out. It's when there are folks, you know, moving into new environments or new places that troubles happen. But for the most part, with the number of people we have and the number of these larger wildlife species, it really isn't that serious a situation, Larry, at least in my opinion.
Well, I'm telling you, as you're listening to the show, go click on, if you're at your computer, click on our Facebook page. The title of the page is The Larry Mueller Show, and take a look. Click on the photo, and you'll get a full-size photo.
It's a nice picture.
It is a nice, a very nice photo. Andrea in near Bessemer emailed to say she has a groundhog in her lilac bushes. All efforts to live trap it have failed. How can she get rid of it?
Well, the issue with woodchucks or groundhogs, same animal, usually comes down to either you try and remove it, and you certainly have a lot of experience with that, Larry. But if you just can't make the trap work, and you can't find the den, in which case the den can be treated with anything from the aforementioned naphthalene and assorted other repellents to some of the gas cartridges that are placed in the burrow and essentially fumigate the burrow, you're left with removing the animal not in a trap or causing it to move, but actually killing the animal. Now, over all the years that we talked to folks about these various problems and made recommendations, all of our extension publications dealt with the lethal alternative, the killing of the animal, is the last the last case scenario. But if it gets down to the fact that you nothing else is working and it's legal to do it, some animals you just can't, there is no lethal alternative. If, like, you have strawberries, like I did 2 weeks ago, and they are annihilated by robin's cedar waxwings and a particularly pesky brown thrasher, I just decided, well, you know, they seem to need them more than I do. That was the end of the story. But you are not going to get legal permission, a permit, or anything else to deal with those birds lethally. But in the case of groundhogs, squirrels, rabbits, fox, and what's the fifth one? Anyway, those animals on your own property, you can remove lethally. That is, you can kill them year-round. So it's legal to dispatch a woodchuck. if, again, you're on the edge of town or outside of town, or if the gunfire is legal, then the animal can be shot with a 22 or whatever might be available. So that is another alternative if all else fails. It's sometimes not popular, but it is a possibility. I don't know where this woodchuck is in relation to...
It's in the lilac, near the lilac
neighbors.
Bush. But
it's in the lilac bush, but if the lilac bush is 8 feet from the neighbor's swimming pool, then the lethal alternative is probably not a sound choice. But if you're in a place where it's safe and legal to do it, it is another alternative.
John in Cedarburg up next. Hi, John. Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you for taking my call, Larry, and thanks to Scott for being on monthly. I got two bird questions. One is involving geese. I recently moved out in the country with a very large pond near the house, and there's six families of geese that are foraging and walking around the house and then going back to the pond. And, of course, they're leaving all kinds of droppings on the driveway, which is unsightly and getting on my shoes, et cetera. Is there a way I can repel them from their route without having a dog? And secondly, being outside at night listening to bullfrogs, occasionally I hear birds calling out at night, and I know they're not owls. Are there certain bird species that do make sounds at night?
Or there may be some other kinds of frogs or other insects, too.
Well, there are... Let's deal with the night sounds first. And there are lots of, some technologies like tape and records and so forth have fallen out of favor. But certainly with a little Googling and Internet work in terms of night sounds, you can hear some of these things. But there's a wide array of insects, some of which sound very bird-like. There's a wide array of frogs that we have dozen species in the state, but some have a particularly bird-like call. Perhaps the tree frogs, most notably, a couple others. And there are a few birds that will call or make sounds at night. The well-known ones, like whippoorwills and whatnot, are very distinctive. So there are some very vocal mammals, too, at night. So there's a lot of stuff going on out there at night, John, and I suggest that to sort it all out, you either, make a couple recordings and play them at the local nature center or send them into Larry's page or whatever. We can try and sort that out for you. But it's also possible, as I said, to get online and hear what some of these things sound like. As far as the geese, they're almost as difficult to deal with in the setting that you describe as deer are in a garden. But there are some good resources. You can go online, and there are publications on controlling goose problems both in an agricultural and a suburban setting online through UW Extension. And there's also a publication, I suspect if you go onto the Cornell University website, you can probably get access to a PDF file of a publication called Managing Canada Geese in a Suburban Environment. I think that's the full title. Mm-hmm. And it goes through all of the options and so forth that are available. But if you've got grass near water, you're going to have geese on the grass. But there are some repellents that are available. One's called Repel, I think it is. And these can be sprayed on the turf and make it distasteful to the geese. The monofilament fishing line barriers that came up a few minutes ago in the context of deer problems. Often a monofilament barrier. The geese will usually walk out of the water to get onto the grass. And either a row over the long haul, a row of rank vegetation, particularly woody shrubbery or tall grass or whatnot, that blocks that approach to the turf may be productive. But in the meantime, a tightly strung monofilament barrier may do the job, and the chemical repellents. And then there are a whole litany, again, if you go to some of these publications, of scare tactics that may help. But I worked with geese for a long time. I have a lot of respect for the bird. I hate to use an anthropomorphic term, but they're smart. They learn where they're safe and where they aren't. They learn when you're there and when you're not. And they can be very challenging to defeat. but some of those things will help you out over the long run.
My lake home, just tell a little story about my lake home. We have boulders or rocks along the shoreline, and my next door neighbor, 10 feet away, had a sand beach. And there were times when there would be 25 geese on his lawn and not a single one on mine, because they could walk right out of the out of the water.
If you can, I mean, probably the most productive alternative in the long run is to block that easy access of the birds from the water to the turf. Now, mind you, they can fly, so you'd think they'd just hop over it, essentially. But when they have the goslings, which is the biggest problem, there's an interval there of 5 or 6 weeks where not only can't the goslings fly yet, but the adults have molted their flight feathers, and they can't fly either. So they want easy access to walk out and browse. So if you can block that with a barrier, you should solve the problem.
There you go. Good luck.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot, John, for calling. Appreciate your call. Wow. Lots of things we can talk about. You've had, and we're sort of butting up to the news time here, Scott, but you caught a lot of fish this summer, and I want to let people know that you've got some good ideas for preserving fish and for eating fish.
You know, I know you fish a lot too, Larry, and we like to eat fish, you talk about some recipes or whatnot, but one of the things that has been very popular the past few years and makes a nice gift for folks too, because a lot of people don't want to go to the trouble, I've been pickling fish. Particularly northern pike and bass. We're going to run out of time here, so maybe we pick this up after the news. But it's not that difficult to make a big batch of pickled fish. The bones disappear, and people really like them. So we'll come back to that.
We'll come back to that. Scott will tell you how to do that, and we'll take more of your questions right after this look at the news. You stay with us. Thanks so much for joining us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us as we take a look at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, UW wildlife ecologist, an expert when it comes to pickling fish, among other things. We're taking your calls, your questions, your email at talk@wpr.org. Go to our Facebook page. We got some great photos now on our Facebook page, wildlife photos at the Larry Mueller Show. I'm looking at one right now of a badger in a picked cornfield. And I know there's that bear is unbelievable, that shot. And there's another one here too, Scott, isn't there?
Oh, yeah. Fisher.
A fisher.
A very nice one.
Mm-hmm. A very nice one of a fisher. So go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show and take a look at those as well. But what about this pickling fish? It really isn't all that difficult, is it?
No, it's not. The whole process takes a few days. But if you've been lucky and you've caught 5 pike, I think is the limit in most places, or the family catches some pike, people are concerned about the bones. But pike, I really like pike. It's a nice firm flesh, and it's very sweet. So eat some of them that way. But for pickling, you just fillet them. Cut them up, take the skin off, cut them up in chunks, and once you've got a bowl of chunks, say 5 pounds of chunked fish, whether it's bass or pike or anything you don't want to take to the deep fryer, then the chunks are treated in a salt brine for 2 days. Then out of that, rinsed off into straight white vinegar for 1 day, and then out of that, and by then the bones have completely disappeared, and their flesh is very firm. And then at that point, you make a brine, a pickling solution, and there's some vinegar in there and usually some white wine if you want a little sweet flavor and whatever additives by way of something like dill or garlic or whatever you like. And then they're just packed in mason jars, covered with brine, sealed, put in the fridge. And within a week, they're ready to go, and they usually keep for 4 to 6 or 8 weeks, and it's every bit as good as any pickled fish you get in a store, and you can replace a little bit of the brine with a couple tablespoons of sour cream and end up with a cream-style version. it's not difficult to do. And a nice looking pint jar of pickled fish for your fishing buddies or neighbors or whatever, people really seem to appreciate it. And there are lots of recipes on the internet, but UW Extension through our food science department here has an old publication, which I assume is still available, called Home Pickling of Fish, which runs you through all the quantities and amounts and timing and everything else for what I just described, and away you go.
Yeah.
It's good stuff.
Yeah, it really is. Renee, I believe, and Stanley up next with a question. Hi, thank you for calling.
Well, to begin with, I've seen five snakes already.
Five snakes?
Grass snakes, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. I have quite a few hostas, and the slugs are eating the leaves. I've tried sluggle, I've tried eggshells, I've tried garlic, I've tried granite underneath it or sand, and nothing's working. Evidently, these snakes aren't doing their trick. They should be eating the slugs, right?
Well, they eat insects.
Well, they eat a variety of things, maybe an occasional slug, but I wouldn't rely on the snakes to help you out of this particular fix.
Okay, how do I get rid of the snakes first?
Well, one thing you could do that it doesn't sound like you've tried yet is you could start putting a plank out or a fairly large board.
Okay.
Put that out and leave it sit and overnight. And in the morning, when you get up, go on out there with a little pail of soapy water, and you're going to have a bunch of slugs underneath that plank because that's where they'll go. And you could put a few of those out, and you can cut the population considerably just that way by throwing them in some soapy water.
Okay.
And I kind of like that system. It works well. Have you tried the beer system?
Yes.
And that didn't work? Did you get any?
Few of them.
With enough beer, you won't even care if you have slugs.
Maybe I have to have the beer. That would work better, I think.
But I'd try the plant. The other thing is, if you've got a lot of mulch...
Okay.
Get rid of the mulch.
Oh.
Get rid of the mulch around the hostas. Take up, they're going to cover the ground anyway. I'd get rid of the mulch.
Okay.
And then I'd put that plank out, and I bet you're going to find you've got a lot of slugs under that wood plank.
Okay. But the sluggo didn't work. I've tried other different pesticides.
Yeah, well, try that because, then you can see the ones you're getting. And if you don't like picking them up, well, you're gonna have to pick them up, Renee. But I would give that a shot.
I think I'll just take the shovel and scoop them off.
All right, that's the way to do it. There you go. Good luck.
Well, thank you very much.
Call back and let me know if it works.
I will.
All right, thank you. Dee in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Dee. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Mm-hmm.
I'm from Madison, but we have a cabin on Island Lake, which is part of the Manitouish chain.
Yeah.
And we've heard wolves up there and at night, and we just think, wow, that's really cool. And I kind of just wanted to address the woman that called earlier wondering why we had to harvest or hunt or kill wolves. But and that's been a concern of mine, too. But we were driving back to the cottage on one of the little back roads, and we thought, what in the world is that in the road? And it looked like three deer, but they weren't quite big enough to be deer. And as we got closer, they were wolves. And this is within very close to our cabin. And they're big. There's three of them. They kind of scampered off. But the alpha wolf, as we crossed kind of the crossroad passing them, she was still watching us, and then she ran off into the woods. So at night, we have dogs. You can't just let your dog out at night and expect that they're going to be okay, because acquaintances of ours have had their family pets killed by wolves. And I can't imagine what it would be like to, hear your dog being killed by a wolf. So it's just... As was talked about earlier, it's kind of a reality of living up there. And, I'm not a hunter. The idea of trapping and whatever horrifies me. But at the same time, I don't want my dog to be killed.
No.
So at night, the last thing you do is you have to let your dog outside. You can't just let them out anymore. You have to go out and I get scared. You know, I'm
sure.
Just, not that I don't think a wolf is going to attack me, but I don't really know. My question is, our cabin is on a peninsula, so would that be a likely place for wolves to kind of come down to the lake and wander around the peninsula?
I don't think, Dee, that we can say anything definitive about that. They could turn up virtually anywhere where they're interested in getting down to the water for a drink or going from point A to point B or are attracted by a dog or anything else. So, you know, you're absolutely right. Dog attacks are somewhat unpredictable and random, but they do occur to the tune of several dozen dogs a year in Wisconsin, and it is very stressful for the dog owners, especially if it's a pet or even if it's a hunting dog or bear trailing dog, which are the ones most vulnerable for death at the hands of wolves. So it's another factor of living in the North Woods, and it's just one of the reasons why some people are more supportive than others of the notion of keeping the wolf population under some control. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate your comments.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I had another, I have another?
Fire sure. away.
Okay. We also, the prior owners of our cabin had sort of left the shoreline like a golf course green, you know, just grass everywhere. So, of course, the geese found that just fascinating and wonderful, and we at one point had up to 60 geese wandering our point. So that's where our dog came in handy because he loved to chase them off. But we embarked on a project of shoreline remediation,
mm-hmm.
And so we've kind of let things go wild, and it's just helped. But the other thing that we did is we had to make life miserable for the geese and their goslings, especially when the goslings were too small to get up on shore, if they felt threatened. And it's taken 3 years to try to, but now we don't have as many geese as we used to, and it's usually just one couple or whatever you call them,
mm-hmm.
and then we can usually scare those away with the dog, and just as soon as we see them, we'll go out yelling and just sound very threatening. It's not, you know, we're not shooting them or anything, but we're just trying to make life miserable for them and their goslings,
mm-hmm.
and have them go somewhere else. But I think if you have a real grassy, appealing shoreline, that is going to be a magnet for them.
And you're on
very true.
And you're on a nice lake. I've caught and released several muskie on
ooh, that. Yeah. Oh, and what? Then last week, this will be my last thing. But it was 2 weeks ago. We looked across the lake and saw this giant thing swimming in the water. We thought, what is that? And we looked, and it was a moose. And a moose. I have pictures. I'll post it up on your Facebook page,
excellent.
Larry.
Excellent.
I want to see that.
That's a cool sighting. I mean, there are a few around, but seeing them is a treat.
It was incredible. I don't know where the poor thing was going to go, but it was, I guess they're pretty incredible swimmers, but it was...
Oh, yeah, they are. Okay. Well, post that up on our Facebook page. I really would love to see that, Dee.
Okay, I will do that.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Oh, that is a good lake. Emily in Woodstock, Illinois, it's on to you now.
Hi, I am calling because earlier you were talking to the lady about who called about the wolves and the hunting of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering how is the population of each species estimated? I mean, where do they come up? There's 1.2 million deer.
Yeah,
okay.
Sure.
Well, it depends entirely, Emily, on the animal you're talking about. Some species are actually counted. For example, in a few months when the Canada geese are back at Horicon Marsh, they will come out and say, there are 350,000 geese at the marsh this weekend. Those are actually surveyed by a pilot biologist from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service who flies the areas where those birds are concentrated, and they do, I mean, it's not 1, 2, 3, 4, but
they take photos, I'll bet.
They take photos. Sometimes some of the species are counted by aerial photographs. So some things are actually counted, not very many. Some species, their population is determined by mathematical formulas. For example, when we were paying more attention to deer numbers that were then reported to the public, than we are now, where we're more, oh, there's enough deer or not enough deer kind of thing, rather than specific numbers. That was calculated by a mathematical computation called the sex age kill method, which was a composite of deer sightings, data from the deer harvest, and a couple other things. Some, when it comes to bears, for example, the last few years they've been using a very interesting, again, mathematical computation based on bait stations that are put out and marked with a chemical, a tetracycline in that case, that causes the bear's bones to take a slight color hue after they consume it. No harm to the bear, but they can then get bone samples submitted by bear hunters, and through a mathematical ratio of how many are colored, how many aren't, how many bait stations were hit, how many weren't, they can come up with a very, very elegant population estimate for the bears. The wolves are surveyed by volunteer trackers who distribute themselves around the state and count the number of tracks they're seeing for these various packs along roadways and areas that the wolves frequent, and then those are all tabulated to come up with this population estimate. That's why it's a range rather than a specific number. So they'll say, in this case, it was 850 or whatever to 890, and that's considered a minimum. So it really depends a lot on the animal in question. Some are computations, some are actual counts, and some, if we said, yeah, there's about 5 million squirrels in the state or whatever, those are just basically
seat of the pants
estimates based on, you know, an average density of squirrels in good habitat.
Right. I figured there was some sort of estimation of it. But so you were saying that with the bears and the chemical that they eat with the bones, well, when they're counted, that's when they're counted after they've been hunted and are already killed, correct?
Well, that's just one part of the equation that's used to determine what the pre-hunt population was. But yes, in that particular case, the population estimate is dependent on some of those animals being killed. That's correct.
Yeah, and then the other, there are other things that are used.
Yes.
Yeah.
I know, like in Louisiana, say for instance, when they're doing the alligators, and everyone has to buy so many of the tags that they have to use.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured that's the way the state regulates how many alligators are legally hunted, because they have to be tagged, and each hunter can only purchase so many tags for the season. Isn't that how that goes?
Yes, and the bottom line is that all the species that are harvested, the amount of allowable harvest, just like allocating the walleyes in a northern Wisconsin lake, how many can be harvested, how many are allocated to tribal spearers, for example, versus sport fishermen, that those harvests, whether it's alligators in Louisiana, deer in Wisconsin, or walleyes in the North Woods, are all predicated on having some pretty solid understanding of how many are out there, and understanding enough about the population dynamics to understand how many can be safely removed and still have the population either stable, or if your management goal is you want more, you take less. If you want less, you take more. And the system works very nicely in most cases. So
it's
all predicated on knowing what's out there.
Yeah. Thanks, Emily. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Marion Washburn has something for us. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Larry. I wanted to respond to the earlier caller about wondering about birds singing at night.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's true that you know, we commonly think of like the owl or nighthawk, whippoorwills, and even woodcocks early in the season.
Mm-hmm.
They paint on the ground, but they also have a twittering sound. They're flying, but that's just early in the season. And I think, to me, the most common night bird that I've heard summer nights on many years of doing the Wisconsin toad and frog survey,
yeah,
is the sedge warbler. There is also a reed warbler in Wisconsin, but the sedge warbler is very common, has a very twittery, you just imagine a little warbler sound, and is common in brush along the roads and in people's yards and shrubbery and tree lines. And it's so common that it, I don't know currently, but it used to be right on the survey form that we did for the frog and toad survey.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to know also about owls and other night birds, and the sedge warbler was listed. So that,
you mean sedge, just a question for you, sedge warbler or sedge wren?
No, the sedge warbler.
Okay.
Yeah, and you know, although, you know, if you know, now you have me wondering if the wren also is around, but I do recall it being a warbler. And I still hear them. You know, I'm up in the Washburn area at night, and I where we were doing the surveys was in central Wisconsin, so I'm not sure where the caller was calling from. And I, you know, and sometimes it's true that the frogs, you know, when they're on a cooler night or just when they're starting to crank up at night, they can sound they can sound very strange, and it, you know, could be mistaken for a bird. But this warbler sound is very twittery and, you know, just clearly a little bird sound.
Well, you know, and that's for the for that caller, if I can't remember if it was he or she, but she goes to the online, you can get bird songs, and that's a good way to do it, is just to type in the name of the bird, and then you, and that call, and you can hear it online and get a pretty good idea. So good points. Mary, thank you so much for calling. Scott, we're running a little short of time, but we've got fall hunting and things like that going on.
Yeah, to some people it would seem early to be talking about thinking about fall at this point when we just put the 4th of July to rest a few hours ago. But in reality, it's certainly not too early for folks who do participate in fall hunting activities to be thinking about things like landowner contacts and getting permission to hunt and doing some scouting of potentially new spots or just scouting where you go to see what the animals are up to and what the populations look like. And, of course, there's always more equipment that you need. I mean, you can't have too much equipment. So a little retail therapy is always a good idea and care of old equipment. But all that aside, there are things anybody who participates in these activities should be very much aware and be constantly checking the DNR websites and weekly news releases for deadlines that are coming up. And, for example, they've just announced that there'll be a very limited number of sharp-tailed grouse permits for some parts of northwestern Wisconsin. That deadline's August 1st, which is coming up pretty quickly. On September 1st, the deer hunt applications for hunters with disabilities. That's September 1st, and there are probably others out there. But the point
fall turkey is fall turkey. Are those licenses gone? Not sure. Well, I'd have to look that up.
I guess the point is there are a lot of opportunities.
Yeah.
We're lucky in Wisconsin to have all of the various opportunities, most of which, from a hunting standpoint, take place in the fall. With the earliest ones coming up, you know, what are we talking? We're only talking about 8 weeks until September 1st, when the dove season opens on September 1st, the early teal season, the early goose season. These things aren't that far away, so if there are permits or other things necessary, people should start planning for that.
And Scott, with that, we're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us today, and you'll be back in a couple months, and we'll do this all over again.
Yep, sounds good.
All right. Scott Craven, our guest today, wildlife ecologist. It's always great to have him. He's been doing this for how many years? 30 years or so?
Something like that.
And he expects to continue doing it. So I'm happy for that, and I bet you are as well. We'll have him back, and we'll talk again. Always the first Wednesday of every month is always a look at the outdoors of Wisconsin, either with Scott or with David Drake and Jamie Knack. So we always look forward to their visits. Tomorrow we'll have our consumer protection specialist on to talk about the latest updates in the federal no-call list, ID theft, and current scams. Stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.